Welcome to Slant Podcast. This is Dana Tasun Burgess. This podcast is an ongoing conversation around the Asian American experience through the lens of artists and luminaries. Thank you for tuning in. Sohyun Bae is a painter living and working in New York. She received a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Rhode Island School of Design, a Master of Fine Arts from Boston University, and a Master of Theological Studies from Harvard Divinity School. Her works have been exhibited in North America, South America, Europe, and Asia, and are in the permanent collections of the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco, the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology at Harvard University, and the Seoul Arts Center Hangaram Museum, just to name a few. She is a 2007 recipient of a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship in Fine Arts. Welcome, Sohyun. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you, Dana. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start our interviews with a way to understand the lens through which an artist perceives their world and creates their art. And specifically, I like to go back to the beginning. And where did you grow up and what led you to become a painter?
Wow. Usually people ask me where I'm from and then I have to ask them which part of my life. Uh-huh. The very beginning, I was born in Seoul, Korea. My parents gave me an option to take piano lessons or drawing lessons. And I wasn't particularly interested in either one, except that when we went to visit the art studio, there was a squirrel. They had a squirrel in a cage. I don't know why, but I wanted to feed the squirrel. So I said art.
So it came from this small connection with a creature from nature. That's fascinating. So you started to take art classes, you were drawn to them. And how did that evolve?
Well, I don't remember anything about the art classes. It wasn't anything significant or substantial. I mean, all I remember is the squirrel. But I do remember coming to the United States when I was 8 years old and not being able to speak a word of English, even though my mom taught English literature at Ewha University. She, for some reason, never taught us English. So it became a way for me to communicate because I saw that through drawing, you know, all these children with yellow hair and blue eyes would gather around me and be amazed. And it became a language, a universal language that I was able to speak.
You know, I can really understand what you're talking about because I grew up in a neighborhood that had many, many different cultures living together. And so for me, my universal language became movement. It was like I realized everybody understood that. And I think it's so true with painting as well, or calligraphy, or any of the visual arts, that somehow we are predisposed to understand the symbols which are imprinted within the paintings that we view. How does your Korean heritage influence your painting in context to your series such as Bearing the Burden and Ode to a Woman of the Joseon Dynasty?
So I think because I grew up in America and, you know, I was educated entirely in America, so I became a very lopsided person. I looked Asian and yet I was completely Western. So the last thing I wanted to do was make art about being Korean. But the strangest thing happened while I was studying abroad in Rome. I was a student at Rhode Island School of Design, and I was chosen to participate in the European Honors Program. And I came across a painting by Piero della Francesca called Madonna del Bardo. And it was in Monterchi at the time. It was in a small church temple dedicated to women with issues of childbearing. And I don't know if you could visualize this painting, but there are two angels that part the curtain of a circular tent. They have matching wings and matching socks. And a pregnant Madonna stands within the circular tent. And that painting was placed within the central apse of this church, which was circular. So there was a repetition of circular spaces that to me looked sacred. You know, the first architectural space, then the circular pictorial space, then of course the Madonna who's pregnant, and then you can imagine her womb. And I became fascinated with that fact. And that was the moment it occurred to me that the Korean hanbok, the chima, you know, the dress of the Korean chima jogori, resembles the pregnant Madonna's figure. And I started to imagine that space inside the chima. So I imagined the chima as a container that I could fill things with. And I began a series, I suppose, called Sonyeo, which in Korean means a young maiden. And that series was exhibited, not necessarily publicly, because I was still a student at the Harvard Divinity School, but it was exhibited at the Center for World Religions there. And the ode to the women of Joseon Dynasty comes from the fact that I started to fill that space container. And at the time, I was studying with Elie Wiesel, and I recalled phrases that he used, like dead leaves rustling about. But also, it was about blood and rich soil. And out of that, I found heads, which later became colossal heads of women of Joseon Dynasty.
Fascinating. And within that description, there's also the tent that you're describing, which has that sort of womb symbol, but also it is made of a textured fabric, sort of like the bojagi also. There's a certain rest of wrapping even as well. Can you tell us about the bojagi series, which is also, of course, influenced by Korean culture, and tell us about how that traditional wrapping cloth made its way into your consciousness, into that series?
That is such an astute question. I don't even think I've ever been asked that. It is true that the tent is made of a specific fabric. It is so important to me. And Bojagi series I made simultaneously as the colossal heads of women of Joseon Dynasty. The reason why I made that is because when I was at Harvard, I was arguing a lot with my professors because I was so hungry and I really wanted to learn, but they just couldn't provide. And it wasn't their fault. They just didn't know. It was in the 90s, and not very many people knew about Korean culture. Now we see bojagi. Now we see Korean wings at just about every American museum. But back in the early 90s, no. So I had to do a lot of piecemeal research on my own. And I always love Korean bojagi because for me, it reminded me of, you know, Paul Klee. Some of them were quite whimsical, colorful. Some of them were quite rigid, sort of more serious, you know. But I was also studying with a woman named Margaret Miles, who used image as primary text. And I thought that was such an interesting concept. And so I wanted to use something from ordinary women, made by ordinary women in Korea, and elevate it, lift it up to make it become a part of the Korean intellectual history. So then bojagi, the fact that it's a patchwork of remnants that ordinary women put together to create these wonderful sort of coverings that they would use to wrap things. But the thing that my mom missed the most when we moved to the States was the Korean traditional floor called ondor. And for people whose culture, you know, demands that they do most things on the floor, you know, they studied on the floor, they ate on the floor, they slept on the floor, they made love on the floor, they did calligraphy on the floor, again became that sacred ground. I was in search of a sacred ground. And I didn't have the money to buy actual granite because Korean traditional floors are granite that they then cover with rice paper. So I used sandpaper, but I found black sandpaper. And then on top of it, I worked with rice paper. For me, as the maker, it was exhilarating to be able to pull the black from the ground as opposed to applying it like ink painting. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
It was because of the black ground, when I went in with the medium on my brush, I was able to pull the darkness from the ground. So the original pojagi were black and white, which is very different from the real pojagi, which are usually colorful. But I did it because I wanted to allude to the ondor, you know, the Korean traditional ground. So I made many of them, and I also made some colorful ones too.
That's beautiful. I think what's so interesting about that series when I was looking at it is that each one speaks also to almost a socioeconomic class system that existed for women, you know, because they're each different. Some are formal, some are whimsical, and you start to understand the personalities and the trials and tribulations of the individuals who use these items. So that was really beautiful. You know, you sort of made this venture, this change into another medium recently, which is this interactive technology. And can you tell us how you made this leap of faith into another medium and what this medium is telling you, how it's informing you about your artistic vision?
Well, I mean, medium is simply medium, and anything can be a medium, but it's the vision that's important. So I don't feel that I've done anything strange or unusual. I don't know if you're referring to the fact that I've been collaborating with Martha Graham and some of the technological things that I got involved in. Actually, I'm simply drawing and painting as I've always done. I was invited as a guest artist in their artist residency with Google. And I was asked to draw the dancers in 3D. But again, it was just a medium. it looked kind of insane because I'm just drawing in air, you know, like if somebody were to see me. But then I thought, that's what I do, you know, because my studio is on 26th Street with these huge windows. And in the evening, they could look right through into my studio. And I probably look just as insane, you know, like painting, jumping up and down, dancing, you know, all that I do while I'm painting is the same.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. I love how you're talking about how you physicalize your creative process, right? Like when you're painting, it's also just complete expression of the emotions that are moving through your body and the images that are moving through your body.
Absolutely. And also because of the scale, maybe I'm really a dancer, you know, because I tend to make large paintings with gestures that resemble dance.
Oh, I can totally see that.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were both visual artists and they met at Cranbrook in the 50s. So they're both abstract expressionist. And I definitely, as a choreographer, look at the stage as a canvas and the dancers as these moving ink brush strokes. And I always have. And so I do think that painters and dancers, there is such an amazing similarity in how they're trying to express through the body.
Yes. And this, I think I've been privy to it my whole life, but now I'm recognizing because I am in the company of world-class dancers. You know, the first time I went to draw the Martha Graham dancers, I didn't know anything about the Graham technique. I just walked in, you know, Janet Elber was so kind, so warm. And when I asked her if I could come and draw, I promised her that I would be very discreet, that she wouldn't even know that I was there. And when I sat there and, you know, with my drawing pad, and there was actually a pianist and a real pianist providing the beat, whether it was 7/8, and improvising, you know, the music. And then the dancers started to move. And the entire experience was so beautiful. I started to tear up. I was just trying to keep up with the movements, and I don't know how, but I ended up with a form on my paper that resembled a figure, but more like a screw. And I was fascinated because I'm not looking at my paper when I draw them. I'm just trying to keep up with them. And at that moment, the instructor told the dancers, you know, the Graham technique of the spiral does not mean that you're spiraling on the surface of the floor, but you must spiral yourself into the ground. And that just blew my mind, that I was able to extract that force simply by observing. And I think when they saw the drawing, I think they were amazed as well, because I guess people come through and draw a lot, you know, but they're busy drawing arms and legs and, you know, whatnot. But I'm not interested in drawing arms and legs. I'm not interested in the surface of things. I'm interested in the force that drives the armature. So that's how it began. And it just made me feel so alive. And that's why I continued to draw them.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I can see how the whole concept of contract and release, right, into the floor and up from the ground, you know, it's so driven by the core, and what you're tapping into and you're able to see in a very empathetic way is that core moving, that core energy combined with spirit. So it's very exciting.
Dana, you're so brilliant. I mean, you really get it. You understand on so many levels of what, I don't know, what I'm trying to do.
Oh, that is so kind of you. You know, I just love art and trying to figure out what is the confluence of a life in art and how does that connect to all of our lives and all of the ways that we approach art. And everyone's stories are just so inspiring, like yours, definitely. Well, I know that we'll be looking for that new book of drawings that you're creating about the Martha Graham dancers. That's very exciting. And you are headed to France this fall to an artist colony. What will you be focusing on?
I don't know. I mean, if I knew, that would be boring.
Absolutely. And why France and an artist colony as well? Which, you know, artist colonies in France, I mean, they have such a history, don't they? It's such a phenomenon.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I was just thinking, like, when when you have sort of at these turn of centuries and every, you know, artists are coming together in very specific places in France and they have these conversations, right? So it's sort of kind of like a Belle Epoque, right? And they're working together and they're painting the landscape and you get all these different perspectives of it. And I think people, you know, a whole new arts movement can come out of a residency at an artist colony in France.
No, not at all. It's nothing like that. I'm Italian as well. I have a whole side of me. Not only did I study in Rome, I ended up marrying an Italian. We lived in Bologna for 7 years. I'm drenched in Italian culture. So France, you know, is something a little different. And so it appealed to me. But more importantly, it's, you know, we have two boys. I went to many artist colonies before I had children. But then afterward, I just didn't have the heart to leave them for a month at a time. So now that they're grown and the younger one is off to college, a part of me, I'm going to be in tears. You know, I'm going to miss him like crazy. But then the other part of me went ahead and scheduled this artist residency. Like, I'm ready, you know, I'm ready to resume my, you know, my life, you know, in the way that it was before becoming a mom. Yeah.
Yeah. The journey continues. I remember when I was going off to college for the first time, I said to my mom, oh, I know you're all going to miss me so much. And she looked at me and she said, what do you think we did before you were born?
And, oh, I like, you know, your mom.
Yeah, she's a tough Korean woman. But essentially she said, you know, we had a life before, we'll have a life after. Go to school, you know.
Exactly. The world doesn't revolve around you.
Totally. Well, we wish you the best of luck. I mean, what a wonderful way to celebrate this time in life when you've done such a wonderful job raising your children And now you can sort of see what that whole experience means. I think for artists, we kind of go day to day in crisis management, and to be able to have that moment of reflection, there's going to be so much that comes to mind that comes to art, right?
Right. But we also have to have that in daily life. For instance, I begin my day just sitting in my sunroom with a sketchbook, and I write. I'm not a writer, but I write all the time. And that's how I absolutely have to begin, that way, in silence. And maybe it's my form of prayer. Oh, well, painting is a prayer for me. Well, so I guess I have a lot of time to pray, you know, since I'm writing and I'm painting most of the day. But I think it's necessary on a day-to-day level to have that moment of silence.
Absolutely. Just sort of switching gears, I ask all of our guests this question. How has the resurgence of anti-Asian violence affected you and your loved ones?
Well, I feel like I live in a kind of a bubble, you know, because we live in Westchester. Our sons receive very, you know, liberal education. I mean, in those terms, embracing. Of course, my studio is in the city and I see everything in the city. There was a moment, actually, I was a little bit scared. And it was when I heard that a dancer, a dainty young lady dancer, was mugged, you know, by a group of people, you know, in the heat of that Asian hate, sort of lashing out. It did scare me. And there was a moment in which I had to run an errand in Midtown, and I asked my husband to come with me. You know, he's 6'2", Italian guy. I think it's such a shame that this is happening, but this kind of thing happens all over the world all the time. It breaks my heart, but in the same way that it breaks my heart wherever that happens to anyone in this world.
Well, and also I think that your work as a Korean American artist really helps build empathy, right, for all individuals. As you were saying, it's a universal language, your paintings. So I think that the more that we look at art and engage with art, the more that we can be empathetic individuals, for sure.
Right. And the more personal, the deeper you go into yourself, the more universal it becomes. The expression can be seen and felt and sensed by the world, I believe.
And speaking of that, what I noticed within your series is that it's your perspectives are sort of going deeper and deeper, and they're becoming more universal, aren't they? Because many of your works have an abstract, organic quality, and they're playing with scale and focus and perspective. And that's sort of beyond just cultural heritage, right? It's going like deeper into some larger consciousness. Can you talk about the nature of water, that particular series?
Yes. Well, so before Nature of Water, it's really important that we talk about the Wrap Shards series. Because when I made the colossal heads, as I mentioned before, I imagined the heads as containers, right? So the reason why they're colossal heads is because I wanted them to be large enough for us to walk into. And the final colossal head is actually a placenta jar. And because I learned that in Korea, during the Gaya dynasty, there was this practice of burying the placenta after a birth. And they put it in a sort of a elongated ceramic jar, and they put that inside a wider, sort of more rounded, larger jar. They put soil and mesh, and they buried the entire thing into the ground. And, you know, Koreans like to bury a lot of things in the ground, like kimchi, to ferment. Mm-hmm. And scholars can only speculate as to why, you know, they did this. But everyone can agree that it must have been some sort of a sacred practice, you know, that maybe they felt that it was the first nourishing ground, you know, for a human being. So that jar then this is what's so fascinating about the creative process, because I'm not interested in appropriation. I'm interested in distillation. And whatever happens in my work has to become a part of me first. And then when it manifests, it becomes a very organic process. So that placenta jar then explodes, and it explodes in the sense of what's called in Hebrew tzimtzum, which is the mystery of the breaking of the vessels. And this is what the Jewish mystics believe, why we have suffering in this world. They believe that the Godhead was separated. It's the divine presence of God, which sometimes is referred to as the female presence of God, is shunned into exile during this cataclysmic shattering of the vessel. And as long as the Godhead remains separate, we will have suffering in this world. So for me, that was such a fascinating imagery, and for a culture that doesn't emphasize image. And I shattered that placenta jar, and I started to imagine what it must be like, what it must have been like. But it was so rich in imagery that it gave birth to an entire series called The Wrapped Shards, where I examine the precariousness of life, you know, the fragility of life. And the Nature of Water series is a continuation of that, but now manifest in the natural world, a lot of glacial images. And of course, I'm interested in the ecological aspect of it, but more importantly for me, it's a further investigation, a deeper investigation into the precariousness of life. It's more about the human and its connection to nature. I mean, it could be many, many things.
Well, it's so interesting because that separation is a universal story, isn't it? Because I was just thinking of the Osiris myth as well, you know, that we keep going back in time, and it's this sort of severing of the different parts that bring about unhappiness, but we're always just trying to be whole individuals again. And sometimes I think it's a metaphor for whole in terms of spirit and body and consciousness, you know? So that's very, very thoughtful. I want to thank you so very much for being our guest today. And I want to wish you the best of luck on all of your future artistic endeavors. I know that we'll all be looking for your work, and we will be engaged in an even deeper way because we know more about you through the openness of your sharing today. So thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Really, it's been really delightful to speak with you.
Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast on your listening platform and tell your friends. Feel free to contact me at slantpodcast.com. It's always great to hear from you, our listeners. Special thanks to our sponsors, the Dana Tasso and Burgess Dance Company, the Cherry Blossom Giving Circle, and the Dedi Liam Gunawan Hickory Legacy Fund.